Strangely enough, this sermon comes from gazing at the moon. My wife and I were sitting out on the deck enjoying the last of the wine about a month ago, and the moon was rising waxing towards full moonness, even as now. And it was extraordinary. It looked so close. It looked reachable. The light from the almost full moon reflecting down across the swimming pool and then directly at our table as we sat facing it, it looked like you could build a stairway to the stars, that you could have walked across the water of the swimming pool, more religious delusions of grandeur, and reach for that moon, walk to it. It was so close and so far away. And I was struck by the fact that, oh my God, human beings have been to the moon and returned safely. What an extraordinary achievement. What an extraordinary dream to have had. What an extraordinary undertaking and accomplishment. And it has been, I think, 30 years since the last man set foot on the moon. And I found myself being struck with a sense of disappointment of what happened to that dream, what happened to that sense of exploration, of adventure, of dreaming big dreams. And I tried to place it in context, remembering the dreams of the 60s, the dreams of JFK challenging my generation that we would go to the moon within the decade and return safely, challenging my generation to take learning and a spirit of generosity, not nationalism, but generosity, into a Peace Corps, and to take ourselves and our time and our attention out to another world, not to make them like us. That wasn't a job to religiously convert or politically convert, but in a sense to witness, to make the abstraction of what an American was concrete to people's experience. And I thought about all of the idealistic dreams that my generation had in the 60s. We would end war. We would take a message of peace out to the world. Science and reason would triumph, and we would go to the moon. We would get rid of the idea that melanin counted for more than character in our society, and we would end racism also. Of all of the dreams of the 60s, the only one that was accomplished was going to the moon and coming back safely. What happened to that dream and to all those dreams? I have a sense that it's a little bit like Leif Erikson having gotten to the Americas, not recognized what he found, and then having to wait a couple of hundred years for Columbus to get here also, before people were reminded or found out what it was in humanity that makes us reach out and go other places. Now, when I shared these thoughts with my wife, she looked at me in that look that she often uses and says, "But that cost so much money, and it took money away from schools and social programs and all of those other dreams that we had in the 60s about where the money should go, particularly where the money should go after the Vietnam War ended." But I was brave or foolish enough to engage the conversation meaningfully and pointed out, I'm not incidentally asking you to take sides during the talk back, because we ended up on the same point, so let's not go there. But I pointed out that to believe that all we got as human beings from going to the moon was Tang and Teflon is to badly underestimate the scope and the grandeur of both the undertaking and the achievement. There was so much that we got in a sense of what human beings are capable of when we put our minds to it. And on top of that, or maybe supremely, we've got a bunch of really important things. We got a commitment to science education. We got from that space program federal involvement in education. And it was a trick. At some level, what the government said was, we have to go to the moon because we got to get there before the Soviets. There was the macho posturing and the Cold War control of space. And there was also the idea of the pure science and the sense of human accomplishment. And what it most importantly did was get the federal government involved in local education, funding science and math, creating teachers and physicists and astronomers and engineers and electrical engineers at a federal level. And it got it past the conservative impulses of the nation that said, no, no, education should only be local. If you let the federal government in, they'll take over. It's the nose of the camel in the tent. We can't let that happen. Well, it happened because we had a big dream that we sold two different ways. But the outcome was the education of our children, even if we're doing it not well and not enough, is the business of every person living in the United States. It is a federal job as well as a state job as well as a local job. And our space program was really one of the ways of achieving that and achieving growth in science that gave us not simply Tang and Teflon, although maybe that would have been enough, but gave us remote monitoring for health devices and health concerns, that gave us computerization and an increase in computer research, that got the power of computers that used to take up whole rooms into our watches and smaller, into little greeting cards now, and did an extraordinary job in the miniaturization, an extraordinary job in communication, begetting the technology, the blessing and the curse of cell phones and the ubiquitous, if invisible, connections that we have with each other all over the globe. However, particularly in restaurants and theaters for some reason that eludes me. But we got all of these things because we had a national commitment and a dream and a vision. The prophet Isaiah says that without a vision, the people perish. What is our vision today? How do we understand ourselves as human beings, and how do we understand our vision as a nation? At the moment, we're organized, as is so often the case in human history, around our negative visions, around our fear, around our terror of terrorism. But it seems to me that every person and every generation and every society at some point has a choice between hate and hope, between expressing our fears and manifesting them in programs, or having a positive vision and a positive dream. Maybe it won't get accomplished, but something that drives and uses us and uses our energy well. it seems to me that one of the things that we can say about ourselves as human beings is that we are explorers. We have always been explorers, sometimes driven by necessity. There's a famine, there's a flood, there's global warming, there's a glacier that's moving down, there's an extinction, a volcano blows up, a stronger tribe comes into the area. Sometimes just because we human beings don't like limits and borders and sitting still and staying still. I have every confidence that were we still living in Eden, somebody would want to go east of Eden to see what was out there. If we were living in Shangri-La, someone would wonder what is in the next valley. We couldn't stay in one place. If we lived in Brigadoon, there would be Harry Beaton wanting to go outside of Brigadoon and break the beautiful spell because, as either Hillary or Mallory said of mountain climbing, we do it because it's there and we're here and we need to go wandering and exploring. Whether it's the Israelites leaving Egypt to wander on the desert or the pilgrims leaving England to come to New England, clearly not an informed choice. They lost a third of their members in the first year. Exploring is not safe. It's not easy, but it seems to be a vital part of who we are as human beings. We want to try to make sense out of our world. We want to see it. We want to visit it. And we are willing to take risks. We need the thrill of risk. We pay for it, for the ersatz risks of theme parks, of rides that get our adrenaline going and relative safety. We jump out of perfectly good airplanes with parachutes just for the fun of it, not because the airplanes are on fire. We look for all different kinds of ways to become excited. But how many of the goals behind those kinds of excitements really have some positive, unifying sense of vision? It struck me for a long time that almost all of the unifying events of every living generation of Americans is negative, save one. And by that I mean there is a generation that knows exactly where they were and what they were doing the moment that they heard that FDR had died. There's my generation that knows exactly where we were on November 22nd when JFK died, or when RFK died, or when Martin Luther King died. We all know where we were on January 28th when the shuttle Challenger blew up. We know what we were doing that early Saturday morning, only less than a year ago, when the Columbia blew up. We, of course, know exactly where we were on that morning on 9/11. We have a unifying series of events that are all negative. The only positive unifying experience I can remember as a nation is landing on the moon, where my generation and older, and probably just immediately after mine, knows where we were. When a human being, not important in some ways an American, first set foot on the moon for all mankind, for all humankind. And it was an achievement. And what struck me about it particularly was how universal the sense of accomplishment was. My North African friends were not, oh, Americans have done it, oh, it's a big lie. It was, we've done it. Bedouins were saying, we've done it. Shatul Qamara. We've gone to the moon. We human beings have gone to the moon. My English friends, yes, even my French friends were saying, we went to the moon. And we hadn't even returned safely yet, but there was still such a sense of exploration, such a sense of achievement. Okay, maybe it just seems symbolic, and we get stuck with Teflon and Tang, but it is so much more for the aspirations of the human spirit to be organized around a positive goal, to be organized around hope as opposed to hate. And I think at no time in our human history have we needed a positive unifying goal more than now. We are living in a world where the nuclear genie is out of the bottle. You can't put the genie back. All when Pandora opens up the box and everything goes out but hope, you can't stuff them back in there. Toothpaste is hard to get back into the tube. And so we have nuclear and thermonuclear weapons. The Israelis have them, the Indians have them, the Pakistanis have them, the North Koreans probably have at least a nuclear device, and the French have them. It's a scary world out there. How can we find a dream that will engage us? When I was a young student at the university, studying, among other things, international law, the name of the book was called Swords into Plowshares. Now there's a dream for you. Spears into Pruning Hooks. And in the book it said, this is about international law, but we have no hope of human beings coming together in the sense of law unless there is something to struggle against. Our greatest hope is that we'll have invaders from Mars to bring us together, to make us cooperate with each other and drop all the silliness of these false distinctions that we create. And that was very striking. And it is appropriate as Mars gets closer and closer, closer than it's been in at least 20,000 years, and we won't see it this close again unless it's in another incarnation. As Mars gets closer, I keep thinking about this. It was interesting in the 50s, invaders from Mars. Well, it was the red planet, so it filled in nicely for those commies, and that was part of it. We could be afraid of them. But, you know, there are two kinds of space creatures that we have. Really three. One of them is the, what in science fiction used to be called, the BEMs. Anybody? Bug-eyed monsters, that's right. Those were the ones that would organize us, and we would fight against them, and with our science, with our wit, we would overcome them, or sometimes just with a regular cold. That was, if you remember War of the Worlds, they all died of a rhinovirus. That was one way that we responded. Another way was E.T., that E.T., this religious figure, comes down with extraordinary gentleness and teaches us something. I think that also is symbolic of the essential part of the despair of some religious impulse, which is we can't do it ourselves. We either need an enemy to come down and get us to cooperate with each other, or we need a mighty savior from the sky to come down and to change our hearts and change our world and change our lives. And what they share in common is we can't do it ourselves. We must do it ourselves. We must find a dream. It doesn't have to be going to the moon. It doesn't have to be longing to make the red hills of Mars green, as Ray Bradbury did in a story. But we need a dream. We need a dream that engages our creativity, that expresses our best hopes. We know that we can respond to disaster. 9-1-1 is an iconic example. It was the very worst of humanity. People with such hatred that they were willing to kill unknown, unnamed people of every race and religion and nationality, and others who were willing to risk their lives to save people of every race, religion, and nationality. It shows that nothing human, good or bad, is foreign to us as human beings, but we need a dream. A dream that is beyond ourselves. A dream that is greater than any of our recent, at least political administrations, Democratic and Republican, have given us. They have played to our fears that are legitimate. They have played to our comfort, which we crave. But I believe that we human beings need more than our own comfort. We need a sense of our importance to each other, our generosity to each other, our ability together to create something in this world that is worthwhile. We are explorers of ideas, of valleys, of hills, of mountains, of a satellite, and someday other planets. Prometheus is said to have brought fire to the earth. I think we need to take our intellectual and scientific hopes and passions and return that fire out beyond ourselves, somewhere on some journey that will use our hearts and our heads and our hands well and gives us something to work for and dream for and struggle with.